Over the years, in the church, we've heard, all of us have heard questions like, well, where's all the miracles like they had in the early New Testament church? How come we don't see those kind of things taking place now? Or we've heard, well, where are all the miracles that were so evident just in the early years of the church as we've known it? Maybe the church that our parents at first attended, or that we were there ourselves. I think back reading the autobiography that Mr. Armstrong produced, and he talked one time about an angel grabbing the steering wheel of the car and making the car turn the corner and go down a particular street. I can imagine somebody listening out there, not from the Church of God community, and hearing a story like that, and they would just hit the punch off button on whatever the contact would be, right, an angel grabbed the steering wheel and turned the car. But indeed, that was one thing that happened to him at that time. I remember a story that was in the worldwide news years ago of an individual. I don't remember exactly how it happened, but he got crushed behind as a dump truck bed came down. He got caught in there somehow and got crushed as this large, heavy bed came down and was in very, very serious condition, injured as a result. And he was healed and was perfectly fine and all right. And so we go back, and there are different stories. We've known different individuals. And, you know, everyone likes to see God's Spirit manifested in some dramatic way. We want to see God's hand revealed in something that is undeniable and obvious to all. But there are people who have gone off, in that sense, seeking manifestations of God's Spirit who have, in the Church of God community, who have ended up basically just following demons, seeking after signs and wonders or manifestations in some open and obvious way. I am sure, and we all would probably agree, that we could get a lot of attention if we emptied a few hospitals. You know, if you could walk in and just heal everybody bed to bed to bed, from front to back, top to bottom, and they all walked out the door, I guess we'd have some news coverage at least that evening. And it'd be a great witness could be given for a very, well, at least a short period of time, but then I would have to ask, how shallow would that witness be? How much meaning would that actually have? How long did Israel continue to believe in and trust God after they were delivered from Egypt? Miraculously. Walk through the Red Sea. You remember how that looked with Ten Commandments movie and the fish are hanging out of the side of the water as they go by? You know, I can imagine that. What's for dinner, honey? Oh, let's grab this one. But how long did they continue to believe after the dramatic miracles of their deliverance? How many believers were there truly believing after Jesus Christ lived his life on the earth? All the miracles that were performed, all the mighty wonders indeed that they got to see, how many of those were actually still faithful and believing after he died and resurrected and appeared to many in the meantime? How many of those that were converted and were faithful at least temporarily after Pentecost and the church grew and blossomed, how many of those remained faithful in the long run under the persecution and tribulations that came down to the end of that period of time? You know, miracles are very dramatic, but again, sometimes the witness becomes very, very shallow in that response. I have spoken in some of my sermons of some of the very dramatic things God has done in Nigeria and some of the great increase that is taking place there. And the church, though being small, has literally, in that sense, been doubling from year to year in size. And there is opportunity right now for a great number of additional people coming to conviction of their service and calling to God and responding in that way. But you know, there's a great risk with that as well, because sometimes people who are easily converted also easily fall away. If you don't walk in the door in that sense, examining yourself intimately and having to make those hard choices, if you walk in the door and it is easy because of some dramatic circumstance that got our attention possibly, then when another dramatic circumstance happens, sometimes it is just as easy to turn and walk out the other way. Nigeria has the sixth largest circulation of the Good News magazine in the world. I think about that. You got the United States and Canada. You got a large church down in Australia, and you have South Africa. So there's places where the good news is in place and in a fair size. I don't know exactly what all the numbers are, but in the whole world, nationally, Nigeria is number 6. The Home Office receives 600 literature requests a week from Nigeria on an ongoing basis. They have one person who processes all the requests from Nigeria because they have to figure out how to address them and exactly what will work postally, and they've got to put it all together and read the writing and send it out. They have one person who works with all of the requests from Nigeria, and they have another person who works on all the international requests for the entire rest of the world. It's pretty dramatic if you think of it in those terms. Now, Australia processes their own. We process our own, so there's certain nations that have their own offices and process their own literature requests. But there's one person working with Nigeria, and there's one person working with all the rest of the international areas that do not process their own mail around the world. It's that dramatic. There's that much activity that is going on there at this time. The renewal rate for the magazine here in the United States, when it comes time to renew the magazine, is about 14%. 1 out of 7. You have 7 people out there receiving it, and when it comes time to renew, you have 1 person out of 7 who says, yes, I want to continue to take the magazine in this way. The renewal rate in Nigeria is about the same, 1 out of 7. Those who are in some respects the strongest prospects are those who renew. And they continue to engage, and they continue to study, and they continue to want support and help in that way. And so those who take the literature and the magazine ultimately are offered or take the study course, on the Bible study course, and they work their way through the lessons for that, and then they have the opportunity to receive tapes from the Home Office, and they listen to those, and then they're offered the opportunity to actually hear sermons in a local congregation, and if they ask for and then receive those, those are the strongest prospects. Recently, we had a number of individuals who had gone through that whole process, received all the literature, received the tapes, receiving congregational tapes over a period of 1 to 2 years. And we said, well, we need to see just indeed what is being accomplished. We don't want seed just going out and being thrown away. So we sent a renewal letter out there, and we asked them to please respond if you want to continue in this way. And you know what the response was? 0. Now that's shocking. And it's kind of dramatic in a reverse fashion to me. How many people would respond if we could put on signs and wonders every week? We could pack the hall, not just with people that are here to be with each other and to keep the Sabbath before God according to His Word, but with people who just wanted to see the show, who people who just wanted to be fed the bread or the loaves and the fishes. But that witness, indeed, would not be very deep. What are we looking for in our lives? Are we looking for signs and wonders or God's dramatic showing somehow of His hand, or are we looking for godly and brotherly love, the fruit, indeed, of God working through us? What would be called quiet miracles. God speaks to us quietly more than anything else. Spectacular miracles do indeed draw deep crowds, and they are lined and stacked up at the door. But again, the witness sometimes rather shallow in the process. Our commitment to God needs to be deep and abiding. It needs to be very firmly rooted. And we need to be committed in a very, very intense way. In the book of Matthew, chapter 12, verse number 38, some of the scribes and Pharisees, speaking here to Jesus Christ, says, "Teacher, we want to see a sign from you. Do something that will show us your power." And He answered and He said to them, "An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign. No sign will be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah." It wasn't fireworks. It was the proof indeed of the resurrection. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. And that's what Christ gave them. And he had to wait to see indeed what it was that he had said. Now, when you look at the other side of that, in John chapter 20, now we're speaking in the context of the church. Obviously the church prior to Pentecost, but the church just the same. John 20 and verse number 24. We have Christ here after the resurrection. And Thomas, as they call now, doubting Thomas, because he really didn't believe it because he hadn't seen it for himself. Verse 25 says, the other disciples said to him, we have seen the Lord. But he said to them, unless I see his hands, in his hands, the print of the nails, put my finger into the print of the nails, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe, where the spear had gone in. And after 8 days, his disciples were again inside, and Thomas was with them, and Jesus came, the doors being shut, stood in the midst, and said, peace to you. Very dramatically, just appears apparently inside, or comes through the wall in the process. Well, I'd get our attention. We'd be listening real quietly. And then he said to Thomas, reach your finger here, look at my hands. Reach your hand here, put it into my side. Do not be unbelieving, but believing. And Thomas answered and said to him, my Lord and my God. He says, I believe. I see it. You have manifested yourself in a very dramatic way. You have my attention. And Jesus said to him, Thomas, because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. Blessed are those who believed and responded to the quiet miracles, because their depth of conviction and commitment, indeed, was very, very firm. When you think about our life and the life of all of us, our neighbors, our community, our nation, this world, are we not surrounded by miracles in a very, very strong and dominant way? Again, maybe what we would call the quiet miracles. Is not the creation itself a miracle? Our life, is it not a miracle? The way our eyes work, the way our skin, John says, the largest organ in the body, the way the skin works and functions. Everything, the little tiny one-celled, whatever they would be, bacteria and other things, they're all miracles. Large argument being put forth under intelligent design, and much of that is being illustrated in various places, and a big contest is now being held between a group of scientists and another over what is miraculous and what is not. What absolutely required an intelligent individual being to create it or to bring it to pass, and what could possibly have happened on its own. I have mentioned before, but under my favorites listing, when I go on the internet, I have a news source that I go to pretty much every day, and I have the astronomy picture of the day right above it. And every chance, when I'm sitting there, I'll pop in, see what the news is, and then I'll go over and say, well, I want to see what it is they're going to show me that God has created. It's astounding. And it always reminds me of his power. I pulled a picture off last night of an artist drawing of what they think maybe our Milky Way galaxy actually looks like. In the past, they've portrayed it as a kind of a spiral galaxy that lays there in a disk. But they've taken pictures now, and they've done studies, and they've looked at the stars, and they realize that the shape is a little different than that. It's like in the middle of the galaxy is this bar, and the bar is like 27,000 light years long. I don't know how they figure that out. But there's just a bar, and then out from the bar are all of the spiral arms. And it just says here, a recent survey of stars conducted by the Spitzer Space Telescope is convincing astronomers that our Milky Way galaxy is not just your ordinary spiral galaxy anymore. It's unique, totally unique and unusual, even in the universe. And it is. It's dramatic. I pulled off another one that shows a portrayal of a galaxy with gas I don't know how to say it. It'd be like taking a ripe peach, a really ripe peach or an egg, and throwing it against the wall. And it just splatters out in filaments of food as it scattered, and they have a galaxy in the middle with gas clouds splattering out in that same pattern just like that. And they look at it, and of course, we don't really know what it is or why. They just can figure out that maybe it's 100,000 light years across. But it's dramatic, and it's incredible what God has done. There was a nebula, which is an exploding star, that was in the shape of an hourglass. And they have no clue what forces would allow it to maintain that shape, but somebody calculated that it was the coldest known region in the distant universe. Have you ever taken a propane tank and let the propane out and it frosts up on the outside? And then when you take something and you pressure and compress it down, it heats up? So they've calculated the expansion of this nebula, and they've decided, whoever made that decision, that it's the coldest known region in the distant universe because of the rate of expansion and the scale of what they're witnessing here. They are estimating that the temperature is 1 degree above absolute zero. Now, that's colder than the rest of the universe. That's colder than distant space. Pretty dramatic. They have a picture here that looks like someone took a galaxy and a chalkboard and drew it and then just smeared it with their hand. And they've been studying it, trying to figure out what it is, because it has kind of a tail that droops down, and that's very unusual. But they've looked at it and they've decided that it must be two galaxies that have collided and are now jumbled together. Now, I'm not sure exactly what would happen on that, because my concept of this, if you put two galaxies and they collided, except for the gravitational pull, they would just keep on going out the other way. I mean, there's so much space and distance in there, it's a remarkable thing. It says the collision started about 300 million years ago. Boy, that's a wreck. Imagine that. 300 million years. Honey, I wrecked the car. Oh, yeah? When? Oh, 300 million years ago. It's still wrecking. It's very bad. It continues today. Although the speeds of stars are fast, the distances are so vast that the interacting pair will surely not change its shape noticeably in our lifetime. So you could watch it for your entire lifetime and it'd be the same wreck. It would never change even by perception because it is so far away and the distance is so vast. Then it shows a picture of Saturn's rings. I really highly recommend Astronomy Picture of the Day. If you want a boost in your perspective on a day-by-day basis, it shows Saturn's rings from the other side, and it says it's like looking at a photographic negative. On one side, the bright rings from the sun shining on them, when you look at it from the back from a orbiting spacecraft, the light rings are now dark, and the dark rings are now light, and it actually reverses the portrayal. And it has a picture here, and it really is. It's quite incredible. So, all around us, and in so many ways, there are quiet miracles simply evident to us by our sight that God has allowed us to see and understand that we never knew existed in that way before. For thousands of years, man had no idea what was out there. We still know almost nothing, but we still do know a lot. So what does God have to do? What does God have to actually prove? Do you want a sign? Anybody want a sign? Raise your hand. We'll take your name down. Post it on the internet. Do you want a sign? Look at Malachi 3. I've never looked at Malachi 3 quite like this, but I thought it was interesting in this regard. Malachi 3 and verse number 10. Do you want a sign? Bring all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house, and prove me now in this, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven, pour out for you such a blessing that there will not be room enough to receive it. So my issue is not tithing per se in any way. But what God is saying, if you want to prove me, if you want to prove God exists, then you submit yourself to me and do what I say and put me first, and then you see if I don't turn and bless you and work with you in a very specific way. So if you want a sign, God says, if you want to prove me, do it this way. What if you want to give everyone else a sign? What if you want the rest of society, the rest of the world, to the degree that they have contact, to receive a sign as well? Well, again, these would be the quiet miracles. These would not be the big dramatic healings and the resurrections from the dead, but this is the obvious and evident sign that God said should be. John chapter 13 gives a sign that should be evident in a different way. John 13 verse 35. By this all will know that you are my disciples, that you have submitted to me, that I am working in your lives and guiding and directing you, that you're responsive to that. By this all will know that you are my disciples if you have love one for another. So God says, if we need a sign from him, then just submit ourselves to him and do what he says and see if he does not impact our life in a very specific way. And he said to let those around us know indeed that he's doing so in our lives, then we should show love one for another to make it evident that the fruit of his spirit is indeed in what we are doing in his service according to his call. Clark was reading from Andy Burnett's letter. I want to reinforce just one part of that. Went through and talked about the homes that were flooded. You know, it does say here, I think there were two people that we still have yet to account for. We don't know what has happened in that regard, and we would want to keep that specifically in our prayers. But it talks about the damage, and he says the cleanup task is colossal, but the brethren are up to the task. They're setting about, putting their lives back in order. It says, as our elder, Rick Avant, mentioned in a previous update, our members are beginning to receive financial aid through FEMA, Red Cross, and insurance. The process of obtaining funds, as you've seen on the news, is not without its red tape, and many are falling through the cracks. It says, because of your donations, though, we have been able to provide emergency assistance to meet brethren's immediate needs, as well as other needs that would otherwise have been unmet. Is on behalf of those congregations, we thank you for your generosity. You know, a fund was set up on LifeNest to try to assist brethren in that way. I think that's an evidence of love and responsiveness and caring for one another that's very, very important. 1 John 3 describes this. God often speaks to us, I believe, shows his hand, guides and leads us, but it's often in a very quiet, miraculous way. 1 John 3 and verse number 16. By this we know love. He says, you know, the world will know by your having love. And now he's speaking, this is the love. This is a description of the love. This is what it comes out as. By this we know love, because he laid down his life for us, and we also ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? My little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth. Let's not talk a good show, which is what? Something obvious and visible. Let's actually contribute and produce and share where we are able and help those in whom we can. And by this we know that we are of the truth and shall assure our hearts before him. For if our heart condemns us, God is greater than our heart, knows all things. Beloved, if our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence towards God. And whatever we ask, we receive from him, because we keep his commandments and do those things that are pleasing in his sight. This is his commandment, that we should believe in the name of his Son, Jesus Christ, and love one another as he gave us commandment, as he told us, doing what he said. I sat down yesterday trying to do a little bit of catch-up in the office and make a few calls and get some papers done that needed to be finished, and I laid out my schedule where I'll be on the Sabbath for the rest of this year. Now, in 1 month, most of us are going to be taking off and leaving for the feast. That was the first thing that just struck me in the face. I lay this out and I'm going, look at this. You know, it's just like, where did summer go? I missed it. Now, I was there, I was everywhere, somewhere, but I missed it. It's like, at least I seem to miss part of it here. We're leaving for the feast, in most cases, in about a month. Let us remember those who are left behind. As we leave, some are indeed going to be left behind. There will be a list of labels put out of those in the congregations whom we know that are staying back, and it gives everyone opportunity to encourage and strengthen their hands as we are gone. But some of those who attend, even are able to go, just barely crawl into the feast financially to arrive, and we should look for those people. We know who has need, generally speaking. And let's remember them as well. Let's love them by sharing with them as well. If we have this world's goods, it's because God has blessed us. It's not because the might of our own power and hand is what drives us along. Let us be generous and share where we are able. In basically every congregation, there are some people who are shut in. They're not just not going to the feast, they're not going much of anywhere throughout the year. Somebody give them a call. Somebody go and visit them. Somebody send them a note during the year. It's nice when someone will print out a list for us of labels and we carry them with us as we travel and we buy a postcard and we stick it on and say, "Hi, we're having a good fun. Wish you were here." That's nice. I hope we do that. But many of those people are shut in for the whole rest of the year while we're home. We ought to care for them and show them love according to God's command. We have to visit them. We ought to encourage them. We have to give them a call and share with them in some way. That's part of loving each other and doing our part. I mentioned in my last sermon that John Elliott had been in a car wreck years ago, gone on to complete disability, his body and mind and flesh, his strength wound down to the point to where he couldn't even hardly function. And I described how he began to slowly, just with a cane, go a few steps and a little further and to try to get back on his feet. And now he serves in Kenya, in East Africa, in that way, and pastors on the side with his congregations here in that way. You know what he told me when we were talking? I don't think I mentioned this part of it. At least I don't remember. You know what he said happened after he was disabled? He said, "Life just went silent." He's a pastor of congregations, and I don't know that he necessarily stayed in that area because he had to go and live with somebody at that time to recover. But he said, "Life just went silent." He said there were no calls, there were no visits. He was just out there off on his own. Now, we all got full lives. I can't do what I have to do. Probably most of you can't do what you have to. And so we make choices about where we put our emphasis and where we put our time. And if it's going to rain and I'm trying to paint the house and I got to go out and finish something so it won't get wet, then that means that comes out of something else and something else after that. Everybody's in the same boat the same way. But I thought it was striking that he said, "You know, when I got sick, life just went silent." He said, "I was alone." It was a terrible feeling. And it was a terrible recognition to know, indeed, that that's what happened in that way. I got a note this week from an individual who went on the archives and listened to last week's sermon, and then sent me a comment that really, to me, I thought was significant. It says, "This morning I listened to the sermon you gave last Sabbath, Work Out Your Own Salvation, and I was reminded of the following observation from C.S. Lewis." Now, I've got some books by C.S. Lewis on my shelf, and I've never really finished a lot of it, but I've read some of it, but this was something I had not personally read. And there's a couple of words that are inserted, the "his" and the "we" and the "we," you know, are put in the middle, but to make the context flow. And it reads this way: "To shrink back from his plan is not humility. It's laziness and cowardice. To submit to it is not conceit or megalomania, it is obedience. We must not be surprised if we are in for a tough time. God is forcing us on or up to a higher level, putting us into situations where we will have to be very much braver or more patient or more loving than we ever dreamed of being before. I would say that's a miracle. That God will look down on our life, caring for us enough to say, I want you to be stronger. I want you to be more loving. I want you to be more patient. And actively working in our lives to force us to rise up to those occasions. But he's not doing that in some dramatic way. He's doing that through the interpersonal circumstances, possibly, just in our lives. Very quietly, but very dramatically just the same. More than we ever dreamed of being on our own. That's the kind of miracle that I think we should be grateful for that even takes place. See, miracles are something that God does for us. Love is something that we do for Him. Quiet miracles. Love to those who receive it. Elijah certainly saw a lot of miracles. I was reading back through some of the circumstances with Elijah. God sustained him incredibly miraculously through 3 years of drought. Then he lived with a widow. And remember the story, how she went and poured out the last little bit of oil with the last little bit of flour, and she cooked it up and gave it to him, and she said, well, let's eat it, or you eat it, and then we will die. And so Elijah sat there and watched as day by day by day, God replaced the flour, replaced the oil. Now let's do what John said. Let's have ourselves set up. Well, you can grab that water, grab your whatever you need for supplements or whatever your support would be in that way, and know where it is. But let's also do what God says. Let us depend on Him. So he lived there as God miraculously, in a dramatic way in this case, replace those items of sustenance. The widow's son died, and Elijah cried out and said, what have you done? How have you brought a blessing? The son is now laying here dead, and so God raised the son from the dead. And then Elijah went out and confronted all the prophets of Baal. And again, another big dramatic story, lightning coming down, burning up the water, consuming the sacrifice. And then the prophets of Baal were put to death. And then Jezebel got upset, and Elijah turned and ran and hid. And it's incredible, again, 1 Kings 19, when you stop and look at just the type of dynamic that was here. And with all that drama, when it came time to talk to Elijah, God did it in a very specific way. 1 Kings 19. Verse number 11. God here turned to, he says, 1 Kings 19, verse 11. Elijah's hiding, escaped from Jezebel, and God comes and begins to work with him. He says, go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord, and behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind tore into the mountains, broke the rocks in pieces before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still small voice. God's making a point here. He said, yeah, I can do great and wonderful things. I have all the power. You know, when you go back and look at the pictures of the universe, and the fact that God created all those galaxies and all the beauty and the drama and everything that is out there. God says, yeah, I have that kind of power, but that's not how I want to work with you today. That's not what I'm saying to you. I mean, if you're doing something and you're struggling with it, does a great big voice shout out and call your name and reach up and grab you and say, stop it? Or is it not a kind of a still, quiet, small voice in your conscience that says, don't do that anymore? God works with us mostly in a very still and quiet way. So it was, when Elijah heard it, the still small voice, that he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood in the entrance of the cave. And suddenly a voice came to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He says, "I've been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, because the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, have killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life." And the Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way." God's speaking to him quietly now. Elijah had to stop and listen. He had to pay attention, because it was a still, quiet voice. "Go return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you arrive, anoint Hazael as the king over Syria." God isn't saying, "Boy, have I got a big job for you," and he's beating the drums, and Elijah's all excited and getting ready to run. God's speaking to him very quietly and saying, "You know, I have a lot of work for you to do. Also, you shall anoint Jehu, the son of Nimshi, as king over Israel. Go anoint the king of Syria. Go anoint the king of Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel, Meholah, you shall anoint as prophet in your place." He gave him an incredible amount of duty and responsibility, but he said it very quietly. And he says, "I'm not doing it in an earthquake, and I'm not doing it in a great fire. I'm just speaking to you, and I want you to listen. If God has to shout at us, what that means is that probably we're not really listening. Those who have gone out looking for signs and wonders indeed have often found demons in the place." Africa is absolutely infested with signs and wonders, and the desire to have emotion and drama and excitement in worship in that way. And people will fall down on the floor, and people will jump up and scream and shout, and they will yell at each other to work up their emotions. And to them, that is religion. It is just a great big emotional response. But again, sometimes it is indeed demonism in the place of worship. It is a very big battle that is fought, and it is something that God's people walk away from when God begins to speak to them in a still small voice. When we have contact over there with a group of individuals, I think the first church group that began to join with us in worship, maybe a year or so back, started with 400 people, and 300 said, "I'd like to stay just where we are," and 100 said, "We will worship with you and share with you in this way." And so when we walk into the next room and there's 500 people and we speak to the leaders, we say, "Do you understand that most of your people are probably going to want to be doing just exactly what they're doing today?" And you sit there in the room and they're jumping up and down and yelling and dancing and just having the time of their lives. And it's the way they always worship. But you try to tell the leaders, "You have to understand, God teaches us. We are here to be edified. He is speaking to us, and we want to listen." And the fact is, even in Nigeria there have been so many dramatic healings. I mentioned the lady that had been bound 18 years in affliction and crippled, who, when she was anointed, indeed God healed her, removed the affliction, and she walks upright to this day. I've mentioned the fact Mr. Schurter was over there when we were there Days of Unleavened Bread, and he anointed four people in the evening, and there were four people healed at that moment. And the next day they were fine. And there was the child at Passover that came with a family member burning with a fever. And again, you anoint the child, and the child is in church perfectly fine the next day. So God works in incredible, dramatic ways according to his choice. But when he speaks to us, he often speaks quietly, and indeed, we should be listening. What was the biggest yearly event that took place in New Orleans? Mardi Gras. The biggest. Now, if they had the Super Bowl in New Orleans, then Mardi Gras was like three times bigger than that. It was the calling card of that city. What is the very first event they're trying to reestablish? The Mardi Gras. Because it is their ticket to fame, and it is the economic engine of much of that city. The Mardi Gras is just a drunken sexual orgy. Show your breasts and we'll throw you some beads. Imagine that. For a few plastic beads, you can take your top off, and that's your payment and your reward. There's places over there you can go meet people and have sex in the back room after you meet them. Commonly understood. Homosexuality, rampantly promoted and openly participated in. And abuse in so many ways. Is New Orleans listening to God? Is New Orleans hearing God's voice? I don't mean every single person, but I mean the whole culture and environment of what is represented there. That's their ticket to fame. It's what they've promoted, and it's what they're trying to reestablish as quickly as they can. More often than not, God speaks to us quietly. And it's important, indeed, when someone speaks quietly, you have to listen in a different manner. If you have to yell at your children, they're not listening. If you have to yell back and forth in your relationships, people aren't listening. When God speaks to us quietly, you have to set aside the distractions, and you have to narrow your focus, and you have to set aside all other disturbances and turn and focus on what God has to say. We are not looking for signs and wonders. What God does, indeed, is miraculous enough, but God often works with us quietly, and he speaks to us softly, and we need to set aside the distractions and the things that would draw away our focus. And we need to listen to him intently in that way.